Hello, welcome back to our next session. My name is Kelly Foyle, and I work in education and outreach here at PI, and I'm going to be moderating our first panel of the morning. We have three panels coming up today, and our first one is a fantastic one because we get to see a great diversity of careers. So basically, we're going to see lots of, we're going to see four panelists, former physicists that are working in a variety of areas. We have Erin Bowe with us today, who is a writer. Jennifer Dodd, who works for the Maker Festival, and we have Anne Kalin at Intel, and we have Sonia Marks at QED Consulting. Welcome, all of you. So I'm going to start off our panel today by having everyone introduce themselves and tell them a little bit about their career path and how they got to where they want to where they are today. And throughout the panel, though, there's going to be opportunities for you to ask questions. So there's a mic there, so you can come down and say your name and ask your questions throughout the session. But to get us started, maybe I'll start with you, Erin.
Oh boy.
Across the room. Maybe you can tell us your story, just sort of in a nutshell, how you got into physics and how you found your way into writing.
I've always actually been passionate about both. I was really passionate about science and astronomy. As a kid, I was the kid in the garage making her own telescope and also writing her own stories. When I got to university, I thought, well, you have to pick at a certain stage, and I picked physics on the grounds that you can teach yourself to write, but it's kind of hard to teach yourself particle physics. I studied experimental particle physics. I was a CERN summer student. I went to graduate school. My particular interest way back in the day was in the quark gluon plasma. We definitively proved that it doesn't exist below, you know, such and such a magnitude, but you know, negative results are still results. In graduate school, I would say I took a left turn, but it was more like I hit a wall and then discovered the exit off to the left. I was ill. It was a difficult time for women in physics. We hadn't discovered like the top quark yet, so the number of times when I personally was asked to model for the topless model is somewhat shocking. I mean, it's 75 pounds and 20 years ago, but it was a difficult time, and I failed out of my doctoral program with only one degree instead of two, and took a left turn into what I'd been interested in, into writing, and eventually found that you can make a living as a science writer. For a while, I wrote like the manual for flipping hamburgers and stuff. I wrote some really dumb things in my 20s. If anybody worked at Arby's, come talk to me, we'll do a spot check afterwards. I did some policy writing, which is writing behind the scenes in the government, the white papers that drive legislation and legislative agendas, specifically around anthropogenic global warming for the Democrats in the United States. I've done some policy work here, I've done some ghostwriting, and most recently I've done science communication here at Perimeter. A couple of years back, my novels took off to the extent that I couldn't do both anymore, so now I'm freelance at Perimeter and mostly make a living as a novelist.
Jennifer, do you want to share your story with us?
For sure, yeah. Well, let's see. So I decided I was going to be a physicist when I was about seven or something. I didn't know what it was, but I thought I was going to go to the Sorbonne in Paris because I'd heard of it. And so I kind of followed a very straight path, really, you know, from there all the way through to, you know, doing my first postdoc. I was in quantum computing. That was my field. I was the kind of theorist who broke experiments by being near them. But that was good because I was doing, you know, essentially mathematical physics. And I was enjoying it, but I was always drawn to things that involve people, you know, organizing events and, you know, science outreach and so on. So eventually I kind of made the leap over to doing science outreach. I eventually ended up here at Perimeter, actually, in the outreach department for a little while. And then, I don't know, I guess I just started wanting to do some other things. I wanted to get out into the slightly wider world than the world of physics, much as I always loved physics and that world. I wanted to see, you know, more about what was going on outside of, you know, this fairly kind of, you know, constrained sort of space in some ways. You know, it's so wide in certain dimensions and so constrained in others, you know. So I went and I ran an arts festival for some number of years called Subtle Technologies in Toronto. And now I'm actually doing, I don't even really know how to describe myself anymore. I have a mishmash of things put together which work really well for me. I have a passion project, which I do for, you know, no pay, which is called Maker Festival. It's a big event in Toronto. We bring in about 20,000 people a year to a free event to experience all sorts of hands-on stuff, DIY, which, by the way, is hilarious for me because, you know, I was the person who broke experiments by coming near them, but now I, you know, am part of this event, and people often ask me, well, what kinds of awesome things do you make? And I'm like, and then I mumble a bit until that part of the conversation's over. But I love being part of that community. It's a very grassroots, you know, community sort of grown kind of space. And so it's a lot of fun. And then on the side, I also make a living. I actually work as a tutor. I teach people math and physics and hilariously chemistry. I quit chemistry in grade 11, but now I get to teach it, which is kind of fun. It turns out it's an awesome subject. And I do that to make a living. I also have a two-year-old, and that's kind of me.
Awesome. Anne?
So both my parents are physicists, so that's sort of how I got into physics. They weren't, you know, pointing me in that direction, but it just ended up being my best subject. And so I did my undergrad at McMaster, and then my master's and PhD at Waterloo. But since undergrad, I sort of knew that I didn't really want to continue forever in academia. So when I got close to graduating, I started telling people that I needed a job, reaching out to my network. I did apply for postdocs still, you know, just in case I changed my mind. But I ended up getting two interviews through friends at Square, that's in San Francisco, I think, and at Morgan Stanley, and I did not make it through those interviews. You really have to study for those kind of interviews. They ask you tricky questions. But I ended up seeing a flyer in the Waterloo Career Services building for Intel, and I just showed up to that. There was free pizza. They asked at the end for you to come up with your resume, and I hadn't prepared it, but I had like a crumpled up copy in the bottom of my backpack. So I flattened it out and went up, and the guy was like, great, we'll see you tomorrow. And then the next day he was like, when can you fly out for an interview? So I ended up getting hired there, and I've been working there for about 4 years. It's using a lot of machine learning techniques, which I didn't really work on in grad school, but you know, you end up working with a lot of big data, and it's really transferable. That's my story.
Sonia.
So I feel like by coming to my story, we've covered a lot of the pieces that you guys, we've had similar experiences. So I got into physics because I was good at it in high school. I'd been good at math always, didn't really know what to do with it. Physics was sort of the answer to that for me. I came to Waterloo, did my undergrad, and I came into grad school here as well. And I was doing my research in quantum foundations, which was fascinating. I really enjoyed the research, but there's limited opportunities, if we're realistic. And I did run into some health issues. The combination of that, I stepped back and wanted to look at other things. So when I started getting back into work, I think I ended up kind of similar to you. I ended up in a data analytics field, not quite as far as the machine learning, but I ended up a lot as the translator in between the people that were deeply technical, like the people doing the machine learning algorithms, and often the client. And so I enjoyed it because it was so similar to physics in that I would take something deeply technical, something like math, and make it mean something. And so it was the same reason I'd fallen in love with physics in the first place. And I got to do it in a very fast-paced, high-demand environment. So I've worked at Air Miles with the loyalty program that everybody hates. So I left there, and I ended up I was working at another startup doing something very similar, again, sort of a marketing analytics type work. And finally, I realized the demand was high enough that I could go out on my own. So that's what I'm doing now, is I run my own consulting company to work with a lot of smaller companies that may not have the budget to hire in a whole team and create the whole team. And I sort of work to help structure out their data and help solve problems with it in a way that makes sense. So it's a nice way to bring everything together.
Awesome. Some of you guys touched on this already a little bit, like the struggles of making the transition, but would you say there's myths surrounding leaving academia, or that people maybe now that you're on the other side, you could maybe debunk some of these myths about what that transition is actually like?
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of myths. I think the biggest myth I'd point to right off is the idea of life outside of academia. There is one, and it's not bad. I think there was a lot of sense of if I left, I would be not pursuing something at the intellectual level that I was in physics. It's a different intellectual pursuit, for sure, with different challenges, but you can still find a challenge, and it can still be interesting and rewarding. I think that was one of the big myths on moving out for me.
Yeah, I actually, in my interview, asked my current manager, like, do you find it challenging? Are there complicated problems you can work on? And he said, I wouldn't be here if there weren't. Like, he's a diehard academic at heart.
So you were afraid it might be boring.
Yeah.
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 Any other comments? Or?
I wish I could have told my younger self that leaving in academia is not necessarily, you know, I did hit a wall. But I think a lot of people leave with a sense of failure, that they'd had this path laid out before them. And for me, it really wasn't, I would not have been happy as an academic. I get to do such more interesting, wide-ranging work and dig my hands into great problems and move from one thing to another in a way that I think academia offers a lot of freedom, but also a lot of focus. And to be more broad in my life is something that I think was really, would have been a good choice for me whether or not I'd hit a wall. So I wish I could have realized that without hitting a wall and been a little bit kinder to my younger self. It's not plan B.
I think there's also a day like today is actually, well, at least when I was going through, you know, a pretty rare kind of thing. You know, I think the sort of culture of physics is very focused on the idea that you're going to become an academic, you know, and that to some degree, you know, people are not well supported, you know, in this transition in a lot of cases, you know. One of the things that we also don't do in physics very much, you know, is we don't talk about feelings, right? I think that's the other piece, is really, this is all the stuff is about feelings, you know, and I used to think it was all about, you know, knowledge or like logic or something, you know. And that's not to say, you know, I haven't left all of my, you know, logic behind. Most of the people who know me still consider me hyper-rational and far too inclined to turn things into, you know, Fermi problems. But but it is, it's all about feelings, you know, and recognizing that and supporting at least yourself in that and hopefully finding people, you know, around to help, I think is something I didn't really know was going to be necessary. I thought I'd just think my way through it, you know. It wasn't right, yeah.
It turns out we didn't design it that all of our first panelists would be female, but they are. And that was entirely by chance. But I know when we chatted on Skype a few days ago, some of you mentioned there was a little bit of guilt associated with leaving academia. Mm. Does anyone want to follow up on that or say, Sonia, I think it was you that said yeah. that.
For sure. I think there was a ton of guilt with leaving. I think there were so many, part of the reason for being in physics was believing in a certain ideal of empirical truth. And you feel like there's a betrayal to that. And when you're a woman, you feel like you're also betraying your gender. Mm-hmm. I think I felt like I had to represent something more than myself, which is just not a necessary amount of pressure, but it's something that's there nonetheless. And I think just taking that step back is really useful to see that the broader world has something to teach us as well that can be rational and can be still in line with that value of truth, and that you can. There's still lots of good you can do. There's so many fields that still need female representation. So that the idea that this was the only place to make that impact, I think was really easy to believe when you're in that academic bubble or stuck in that ivory tower, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I was surprised when I left to find out that like tech is far, well, at least as challenging on that front, if not more. Mm-hmm. You know, that was something I was interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we were all talking before to say that we all thought that we were the woman who had been asked to be on the panel, or at least several of us did. We were all women, so that was kind of nice. Yeah. But, yeah.
I'm going to invite anybody who would like to come down to ask a question. If you want to come to the mic, you can do that. But I'm going to follow up by asking, you know, Anne, you mentioned that you went to a session and you had probably no idea about Intel very much at that time. But what was some of your strategies to look for new professions? Like, what are some of the, how did you find out about different jobs?
You just have to tell everyone you know that you're looking, and some will follow through. They'll get a friend of a friend to contact you.
Mm-hmm. And informational interviews are the biggest trick I learned. People like talking about what they've done. And so I thought I was asking so much of people to sit down and give me guidance. And it turned out that everyone's really happy to do so. And so that was something I made use of to learn about the different opportunities out there, was to just talk to anybody I could get access to, anybody.
And I sort of followed some of my other passions beyond physics. So I had a great physics background, and it's a great skill set. Not that anyone I've ever worked for has ever been interested in discovering the quark gluon plasma. But it's a great skill set. You have a wonderful technical background to talk to other technical people and then translate it back to non-technical people. I often say my job is basically translating physics into English. Yeah, the physicists don't think that's funny. Everybody else thinks that's funny. So the translation, being a physicist gave me a great background to always be in a little bit over my head and always be willing to ask questions and always be able to chase down the big ideas and do the background research and bring things on board and understand it. But my X factor is that I can then turn that into prose. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably a good idea to have some idea of what your X factor is and follow that in interesting directions.
And I guess the thing that's interesting is that once you've got the physics thing, the X factor, you know, it doesn't need to be something that you're, I mean, as a writer, I'm sure you are actually a spectacular writer, but you actually don't need to be such a spectacular writer for that to be a really useful X factor, because once you leave physics, your real X factor is being a physicist.
That's right.
Yeah, that's true. That was something, you know, I guess I was used to meeting, like, you know, physicists who didn't care I was a physicist because everyone was, or people who'd spent far too much time around physicists who didn't really want to hear another person's, you know, physics story, and actually leaving physics and being out there, and people would be like, wow, you know, and they just really thought I was impressive for having done physics. It was so nice, you know, such a nice change, but also very useful, right? It really becomes this, like, distinguishing feature, you know, once you're out
That's
there.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I'll invite you again. This is your opportunity to ask questions, so if you want to, we've got anyone who'd like to come down.
Hello. My question is, if you want to follow your passion other than physics, I mean, that's if this is your passion, but it's something else. Instead of fitting into the world, what they have to offer, what they need, like the demands are, like, how do you make this financially sustainable? Like, I mean, how, what's the challenges, you know, what, you know, for example, for the writer, for Jen, who organized science festival, promoting science, like, unlike this data science stuff, which has a lot of money in it, like, how do you tell yourself that it's, you know, a safe direction to go in, and how do you make it happen?
Anybody got advice
on safety? It depends what your passion is.
Yeah, I feel like we both landed on the data science side of it, so there's a lot of incentive there. One thing I might suggest is just trying a mix, because I think you've mentioned this a little bit. It's okay to do a little bit of your passion and a little bit of something that makes you some money. Mm-hmm. It's okay to balance. I think experiencing working a bit more freelance or things like that, you can balance ways to make it work. It just takes a little bit of extra... A little bit of extra elbow grease.
And Jennifer, you have kind of a model where you do, like, the Maker Festival is something that is your passion, and then, not that tutoring isn't, but it's kind of a combination.
Yeah, I think really, you know, something that I guess I kind of went through over a long period, really kind of figuring out was where, you know, my own balance lay between wanting the security of a regular job, wanting a lot of money to spend, you know, and so on. So, I mean, at one point, you know, I owned a house and I had a car and, you know, and I felt like those were all sort of normal things that one did. But eventually I realized, actually, I'd rather earn less, do more of the things that I wanted to do, and, you know, maybe not own a car and, you know, live in an apartment. you know, not that you can't potentially actually have all of those things, but realistically, you know, when we start saying you can have it all, it gets a little less realistic, you know. So I think it's also about finding that balance. So, you know, if you really want a high-paying job and a lot of security, that's available. You know, combining that with your passion may be harder, depending on what your passion is, right? But if you're, you know, feeling a little more flexible, you know, I do not earn a lot of money, right? I earn enough money, and I have a very good time doing it. But
yeah,
you know, you
that's
have to find
a familiar
that balance,
sentiment.
Right?
Yeah, it is scary. Canadian novelists make on average $12,000 a year, and that's after you've made several cuts in your apprenticeship, right? Well, you don't think of writers as having an apprenticeship, but there really is a cursus honorum, just like there is in academia. So side projects are necessary. For me, I've always been happiest when my side projects line up really closely with my writing ability. You know, so I've been happiest as a science communicator or doing other kinds of writing. On the other hand, I have a friend who's a novelist who works for the city as, like, she's one of the people that plants the flowers. So she's writing in her head all day. So you can do that too. You have a day job that doesn't draw from that well and come home energized to draw from a different well. So, but it is hard to leave the course of academia, which seems so laid out and smooth in front of you. On the other hand, I think some of the senior academics in the audience are going, but it's not. Academia is not a safe path either.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. So yeah, at any time, if you have a question, you can come down. Maybe you guys want to tell us a little bit about what your typical day is like what you do at
work. Has anybody got a typical day?
You've got the most typical.
Or a day on average.
you can represent this.
Right, so I said my group tries to, I work in defect metrology, so we're looking at defects on the wafers and nanometer scales, imaging them or different techniques. And we try to make it so people don't have to do as much work. So one of the main things we do is automatically classify the defects by using machine learning techniques, image recognition, like when you Google stuff, or if anyone was at Roger's talk last week, he had a lot of examples of the image recognition where Google can just tell if there's a dog in a picture or not. So we get a lot of requests to like set up this technique on like new, I don't know how to say this without revealing too much IP. Yeah, a lot of requests to set up new things like that. And then, so that's like the more boring day-to-day stuff. And then we have a lot of freedom to come up with any ideas that we have to build tools that can help people. So like, sky's the limit. You see someone doing something, you're like, I can automate that. And you can take time to work on that, collect the right people that you need to help you get it done. And then we also do some academic stuff on the side where we're learning more about different machine learning techniques and neural networks so that we can be even better at our jobs.
Awesome. Yeah. As an example, it's just something different. What I'm doing right now is so all over the place, but when I was working somewhere like the last startup I was at, my main client was based out of France. So my early mornings usually were check my email, see all the things that they've done through a full day of work, realize I already feel behind, quick client meetings if we had to in the morning, meet with the team members we'd work with. So I would have to very quickly often meet with our client service representatives because I would be the technical client person. So then you're meeting with a lot of people just to get straight what needs to get done in the next day, hours, whatever, depending on what your deadline is. Then you're trying to make sure an email goes out to the correct targeting based on a marketing strategy combined with whatever data science models you have at your fingertips, as well as trying to move forward different projects to always maximize how much money your client can earn. So that was sort of more the problems that we'd be dealing with in something that's marketing or client focused like that.
Great. I don't know if you guys, oh, you have a question?
Of course.
Maybe we'll switch over.
Yeah, kind of related to getting into more of the specifics of what you guys are doing. which is what I'm interested in. What are some of the most interesting challenges that you've had in each of your careers in industry?
That's great. Maybe we'll start with you guys.
Me? Oh my goodness. Everything that's coming to mind is novel related, which is probably not actually super useful to you. I went to Mongolia to research Mongolia. Go to the source. Take medication with you. You will catch amoebic dysentery. practical on the ground advice from your panelists today. For me, the challenges have always kind of been around the inflection points, making transitions from one thing to another. When you work in politics, your job depends on the job of the senator whose office you're working in. And I don't know if you guys know this, but they are elected, and you know, then they fire everybody. And so it's a very unstable process. And so making the transition and deciding, taking a step back and not taking the first thing that's offered to you, but taking a step back and saying, what did I like about that? What did I dislike about that? What would I like to learn that I don't know how to do? I often find myself taking on jobs that fulfill that last requirement, what would I like to learn that I don't know how to do, which is probably backwards, but has always worked out well for me. But those inflection points have always been the hardest challenges for me.
I would definitely say inflection points for sure. I think it kind of comes back to what I was saying before, that it's sort of, you know, recognition that it is all about feelings, you know. I think, again, I used to sort of think that I would just figure my way out to not, say, being, you know, scared of doing something. And actually, I've kind of come to realize that the trick is just to be scared and to do it anyways, you know. And,
absolutely.
And that's you know, a hard thing. I mean, one of the things that I do for Maker Festival is I ask for money to support it, you know. And you know, the first few times I did that, in fact, even now, you know, it's funny, I got nervous just thinking about it. I get really nervous just thinking about doing that, you know. And sort of recognizing that, you know, I just had to kind of step in and do these things that, you know, were very uncertain, you know, to me, at least, with my background. They weren't things that I knew how to do at all, you know, and I couldn't think my way through them. I guess, you know, I eventually kind of realized that that imposter syndrome, right? Like, you know, pretty much every physicist feels it. I guess I also thought that was just about somehow physics or maybe academics more generally, but I now know that pretty much everybody has it everywhere. I was talking to one of my festival team members a few days ago, and he was saying that when he first joined the team, he had massive imposter syndrome. Now, I thought he was awesome from day one, but it turned out that he thought he had no idea, and we thought he was totally crap, and we were just, like, being nice, you know? Instead of knowing that, like, everyone feels like that all the time, I don't know, I guess, I don't know if it makes it easier to feel like that, but it does, I don't know. You know what, I don't know. I don't really know what to
say. So I had this project where I had to basically replace some software that a supplier was providing because they wanted to stop paying for it. So I had to design this new system from scratch, and like I did it, everything was matched, it was great. But the challenge I ran into was that I actually had to convince people at work to adopt this new method. I couldn't just say, like, this is what you're using now, because there was so much pushback. So there was this psychological component where I had to convince them that it was just as good, if not better. And that was sort of an unexpected thing of working in the business world, that you don't really have to do as much in academia.
I would definitely second that one. Communication and working with a team was one of the first challenges I found moving into it. But my second sort of bigger thing was the speed. You're, especially in the startup world, it's a lot of life hacks, efficiency hacks, how efficient can we make it? And working at that kind of speed, mistakes happen. And that's tricky. That's really tricky to get used to when you're used to that academic world where you write a paper, it gets critiqued by referees, you have a million times to improve it. It's very much in academics where you're closing every gap and everything has to be 100% closed or someone will find the flaw in your logic.
in the business world, I found they often say fast is better than perfectly correct. So trying to make that adjustment, I have found to be difficult because I like closing all the gaps. Mm-hmm. I like making sure I've got a logically complete solution. And mistakes happen, and trying to deal with that and trying to find that, I think I learned that it's how you respond is more important than whether you make the mistake in the first place. And that was a really big shift from the academic world for me.
Yeah, go for it.
So this was a question mainly for Erin, but I think the question extends to the other panelists as well. So since you decided to become a writer, and you'd always been writing even before you formally decided to take it up as a career, is my understanding of it. Did you ever feel that, or did you in fact ever formally sort of train, or did you go to school for that, or did you feel you needed to do that? So that's the question for you. And more broadly, the question for the other panelists is, to what extent coming from academia and moving to a different field, you can just wing it? Like you can just wing it? And to what extent do you think you need to train? Do you need to retrain yourself? Like what modes of think, like for example, what you just said about, you know, being fast over like completely correct. Like that's one, for example, meta skill. So what sorts of things do you think you can just wing, and what is it that you need to actually learn, like in your own experience? So, Erin and...
I have absolutely zero training as a writer. I took some electives as an undergraduate. I've taught creative writing, but I've never studied creative writing. I have studied I've taken a handful of like professional development or graduate level courses in things like, some government related ones, some policy related ones. I have found them useful mostly for developing my network. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while I'm like, oh, that is the perfect solution and I can just pull it off the shelf. But it's rare. Usually it's laying a bit of foundation that I can trab further out on. And know some vocabulary and meet some people, and it's sort of a shortcut to breaking into different pieces of the field. I've gotten an awful long way just by winging it. I don't know if that's true in absolutely every career you might jump to, but it's way more true in the outside world than it is in academia, where we think the qualification is the be-all and end-all. There's a lot of on-the-job learning.
If you're riding the edge of innovation, you're making it up anyway, because it hasn't really been figured out yet. So I think as part of the fields that are trying to innovate, everyone's figuring it out. I think this goes back to the idea of the imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. I think from an academic background, you think you need a lot more training than you do. You can figure out a lot as you go. That's where the speed gets tricky for sure, but you can figure it out. Having the stomach to do that is a whole other thing. But that's something you can make that mental leap. But I think in terms of the technical skills you need, you'd be surprised. And you'd be surprised how transferable physics is. I think having a firm math background, having even some coding, I mean, I didn't have a strong coding background, but I learned. And you can surprisingly learn pretty quick. So I think that's... I surprise myself. I think I know a lot of people just surprise themselves.
One thing I did do at the recommendation of a friend is I took an online class on machine learning. It's like Andrew Ng's Coursera. It turns out everyone who started in my group had already taken that course too, so that ended up being invaluable. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of it, Intel hires at least everyone I work with straight out of their PhD, so they sort of expect you to be academic minded and then they train you out of it.
So I totally agree with everything you guys have said. I think the only thing I might add to it is that something that is important is figuring out when you don't know the thing that you really do need to know, like doing the online course and doing it. And sometimes I think we can be a little bit too inclined to think, well, I'm smart, I know things, and it'll be okay. I'm reminded of
paper from, well, a pretend paper from many years ago from the Journal of Improbable Research. It was called Simple Model of Physicists' Simple Models. You know? And there's definitely, I think, a little bit of a tendency to think that, you know, we can just do things. And it's sort of both true and just needs a little sort of finessing to make sure that it is true.
Physicists are the people who like show up at the nuclear power plant and think that they can run it because they understand what nuclear power, like they understand what fission is.
Yeah. I'm like, that's not true.
It turns out not to be true, but and so there are places where you need very specific qualifications, but I think that they're rarer than you might think.
Well, I felt like a lot of it is about, you know, not even necessarily getting a qualification, but finding a person and like sucking them dry.
Oh yeah,
I've done quite a bit of that.
I believe in the ask people school of research.
Yeah, and the stalking people school.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Networking.
It's called networking, and it's good.
Sorry, I always use the wrong word, but you know what I'm talking about. Right? Like finding the person, I've definitely had a lot of those people now in my life. You know, like I learned how to ask for money from a person who was fantastic at asking for money. You know, now I'm like medium at asking for money, and that's all I need. You know.
Awesome. Another question.
Hey, I'm Matt. One question I really want to ask. I've asked this to a few people. I feel like you mentioned this before about how physics really leads people down one path of academia, where you go to school, you get your PhD, you do these things, right? And I feel like it does a bit of a disservice to a lot of people too, like at an undergrad level in particular. And I felt like that in my undergrad. So my question is, what would you tell undergrads about how valuable their degree can be in the workforce?
I mean, I actually do tell people the answer to that question quite a bit because I teach a lot of high school and you know, university students. And generally what I tell people is as long as they're really enjoying what they're doing, it's never going to be a bad thing to have this background, right? So as long as you're still enjoying doing, you know, your physics or your math or whatever, it's hard to say that that would be, you know, the wrong choice. If you're hating it and forcing yourself through thinking, you know, perhaps I'm going to become an academic or maybe not because I don't even really like it, that's clearly a mistake. You know, it sort of seems obvious, I guess, when I say it that way, but you know, I feel like that perspective can be a bit lost. The thing that you're saying, though, that I think is really true is that I think a lot of people do go through thinking, well, if we want to, we can all become, you know, professors, right? Like, that's what happens. We all get faculty jobs. And, you know, of course, the numbers are that, you know, some maybe 5 or 10% of PhD students can actually get academic positions. That's just the, you know, that's the mechanics of the numbers that work out. And I think I do try and let people know that that is true. And I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, that that's true. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's an important thing for, you know, making your decision, I think, and you know which way you're going.
Mm-hmm. It's strange, I think, that undergraduate students and to some extent graduate students in the sciences don't, like English majors don't think they're going to be English professors, and psychology majors don't think they're going to be psychologists necessarily, but physicists, as a large group, think they're going to be physicists. And I think knowing that your background is way more flexible than that, and that you have many more options, is something that I'd like to tell more undergraduates and young graduate students, and even high school students, like making the decision of what to study earlier. You know, your path might not be straightforward. You might have left turns and right turns in it. It's not a bad idea to, like, not. I picked physics instead of English. I don't regret that. But I wish I hadn't shut out English quite so much. So I spent 5 or 6 years not doing it at all because physics is hard. And it really consumes a lot of your time, especially at the graduate level. So I wish I hadn't picked, and I wish I'd realized that I had more options. So I wish we could communicate that to younger people.
I think that's all good. The thing I would add is that it's a really useful background, but you may have to make the connection for people as to how it can be useful. I remember someone looking at my resume when I was starting to look for work, and they said, okay, so I get it, you're smart. So what? they don't know yes, you're smart, but what can you do? And it's really important that what you can do is more important than what you are for all of these, for anyone who's going to hire you. And being able to explain to them how a physics degree was going to be useful, how my math background could help me solve any problem they could put in front of me that was sort of technical, and I could model it with any math system they gave me. I think being able to make that connection for people was a really important skill to pick up when I was going along and making that transition.
So, sorry, I know it's not really my job, but can I just ask, how did you make that connection for people before you'd like done it? Because that's something I don't
know. How did I make that connection?
Like before you'd had the experience of, like, now you can do it, but.
Excuse my language, but some of it was just bullshitting. but some of it too was knowing that, some of it was researching. So I did talk to people and trying to understand what problems they were trying to solve, and then thinking about what skills I had and how I could make the two connect. I think in physics you're used to making really strange connections. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of just keep relying on those same skills of what's the structure that you guys are dealing with, what's the problem you're trying to solve, and how can I make something, how can I make a connection there that wasn't there before? Mm-hmm.
So, seeing that you are successful professionals in your respective fields, I had a question about professionalism. So, I mean, we already touched upon that, talking about financially sustaining and figuring out if you can make your career financially a career. But, like, also, do you think you've found your voice? So, I mean, you changed paths, and now you're doing something else, but still, like, the process of finding your voice and being useful to the society while also doing something you like. Is it an ongoing thing that you keep coming back to? And like, I've heard this phrase where you're like doing, it's called like one for the soul and one for the kitchen kind of thing with careers where you have to like cater to both sides. I was just wondering, yeah.
I think it's a really dynamic balance, to use the physics term. Between to be useful and to make a living and to stay happy. I'll talk about novels because it's so easy to abstract from that. My first novel was a fantasy for very young readers, like 9 to 12. And I kind of figured out how to do that. So naturally I decided I would write a fantasy for older readers because it's a whole different skill set. Then I'm like, well, I also like science fiction, so I switched. And then I'm like, I don't know what would be really good is a completely realistic story set in a distant place that I know nothing about, for this market. So I have kept that drive to learn and to research and to apprentice going by continually throwing myself in over my head. And also that has the happy side effect of growth. As a profession, I can now tackle any of those things or, you know, like go speak at a school about any of those things, which is an important part of how I make my living is public speaking. So it is very dynamic. There's never been a point where I was like, I'm happy with this, I'm just gonna keep doing this. Mm. It's always been pretty knife edge, and I have just kind of attempted to continually fall forward. It hasn't always worked, but it's mostly worked.
I found too that if you do find that place where you're like, this is really great, I'm perfectly happy here, something changes. Mm. There's no such thing as a stable equilibrium too, again, still a physics term. It doesn't exist in real life. And I think it's just a matter, there's no tenure. Like you just have to kind of keep searching, keep trying stuff. And like you said, the advantage of that is that you keep learning. Mm-hmm. So.
I think that's one thing that maybe people have kind of come back to a few times. It seems, at least, that you know when you go down the road of physics, there's tenure, right? So all of a sudden, my career gets locked into this very safe place, and the alternative to not doing that is like a very, very seems like series of uncertainty and transitions, and you know the choice seems to be one of a life of security versus uncertainty, which is
seems terrifying. Is that a myth or is that true?
Well, there are secure paths outside of academia. We just haven't taken them. I think that's just something very specific to what we've been talking about, that it's less secure because we're looking, I think, a bit more at the alternatives. But there are secure paths out there too. The tenure is not the only secure thing you can do, just as a reassurance.
I think there's also a lot of security. Like, I've always felt a lot of security in, you know, knowing that I have these technical skills, and if one day, you know, I've got a two-year-old, right? So suppose he got really sick, right? And suddenly I'm like, you know what, I need to double my income. Well, I kind of feel fairly confident that I could do that. I wouldn't necessarily be really happy with that choice, you know, career-wise. Mm-hmm. Although I kind of think career is a myth, but I mean, I know I say it says careers day, but I kind of feel like career is a myth. But anyways, that aside, you know, that confidence, actually, I do feel that, actually. I guess it may be misplaced, but, you know, yeah. I think that's an important thing to know as well. Mm-hmm. You can parachute, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the question.
As far as I can, I could remember, your story seems to be basically projecting the fact that you guys are pretty happy with where you are right now, and mm-hmm. I think that's great. But one thing that has always been bugging me is that some of the things that you four of you are doing are kind of fun and interesting. But what I would like to know is how much does financial stability and other more pragmatic considerations actually factor into your decisions to leave academia? Because a lot of people put their main priority of leaving academia in the fact that it's easier to get stable life unless you somehow miraculously just get into faculty positions and then mm-hmm. life becomes happily ever after. And mm-hmm. yeah, so at least from where I came from, I came from Singapore, and it is an ultra-pragmatic society where basically there are too few people doing PhD simply because they think it is just way too high an obstacle against stability. So I would like to hear your opinion on that part.
How much financial stability has... Well, I think that we talked about academia as the safe path, but you're quite right. I mean, as women, we always hear this leaky pipeline metaphor, but the truth is, you know, it's like the little claw that comes down and grabs like one person out of every 10 at each stage. That's terrifying. Yeah. I remember that as being, is it still terrifying? I remember it as being terrifying. Yes, okay. you know, in a way, leaving and like having a lot of options open to me, I don't know that stability is necessarily the world I would choose, but there's a lot of possibility open to me. There are a lot of things I could do. It's kind of a tough job market right now, but I really feel fairly confident that if I wanted to go out and get a 9-to-5 job that paid fairly well, I could, and in fairly short order. So having that kind of possibility open to me is not a bad thing. I'm glad that I don't have to. I really like what I do, and I'm willing to compromise on not making a ton of money and having all this crazy side hustle going on. And, you know, occasionally your publicist sends you to Southern Saskatchewan to speak in the greater Moose Jaw area for 2 weeks. So, you know, every once in a while you're like, what? But it's been good. And I think having that sense of possibility rather than stability has been, I really felt like a failure when I first left academia, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't make any money, and I did really dumb things, and it was awful for like 4 or 5 years. Really a difficult period, but now I feel really optimistic about it.
Anybody else want to comment on? I think there are trade-offs to make with stability and security. There are so many options out there. I think we're representing a few of them, but there are just so many different things you can do with a physics degree. Some of them, the job market's great. Some of them, there's lots of security. There's different types of security I think you alluded to before. I think you can, if you want stability and security, you can get it faster than you can get in an academia because you don't go through a postdocing period or anything like that. And you can, if you want to earn a higher amount of money quickly, you can. So there's a bigger space of possibilities, and therefore you get to just choose on those dimensions. So it just depends what's important to you. And figuring what out what's important to you can help guide the decision of what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. So our society, you know, in some ways set up so that they can reward people financially for doing things with high societal impact, right? Like in a way, in some fields it's true. But is it true in general, like, you know, if let's say Jen makes a festival and it brings science to a lot of people, and I think it's a high impact thing, but the money isn't there. Like, so sort of, how is a myth that when you can make a societal impact, you will trust that the money will come your way? Or is it like some, like, how do you, you know, negotiate between making an impact and making money for yourself?
I mean, I can address the festival thing. We could make a living doing this festival, there's no question. But that would turn it from a job that I love into a job that I don't like so much, because I spend a large part of my life, you know, writing grants. You know, people will give you money for stuff that is valuable a lot of the time, but you don't always want it. At least, I don't always want it, you know? So again, I mean, I think that's the thing we sort of keep coming back to, right? You know, people talk a lot about like planning your career and knowing what you want and stuff like that. And, you know, I was saying before, I think career is a myth. And it's maybe a bit too strong, but I think that the idea of figuring out what you want to do for a career, capital C, like that really works well for some people, but it really doesn't for a lot of people. And I think speaking for myself and maybe for some people here, you know, I follow what you might call a greedy algorithm, right? I've kind of looked around like, oh, that looks good. I'm going to go there for now and, you know, and not worry too much about, you know, the long, long term. And if you know what values you have and what kind of life you want, I think that's probably more important than knowing what career you want, if you see what I mean. Because within those things, you can always look around and see, well, you know, how can I make the impact that I would like? What are the opportunities that are available to me or which I think I can create? And then you can choose the one that satisfies those, you know, those constraints. You know, one of my constraints, you know, in becoming and not becoming a physicist was deciding that I didn't really want to work two full-time jobs for some number of years, which as far as I can tell is the way to tenure. You essentially work a full-time teaching job and a full-time research job for a few years, and then you get tenure, you know? And I don't like working hard. I am a lazy person. I love not working hard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was something, I mean, I'm joking a bit, but not really. I mean, that was important to me, you know. So, yeah, I don't know.
The other part of your question I just want to address is the idea of impact. Impact isn't a singular thing. The same way we've talked about security and stability not being quite as singular or linear as there may be talked about. I think impact is often talked broadly in terms of what impact can I have on the most number of people. But local impact is relevant as well, in terms of the people you work with, the culture you create around you. And that comes through a lot in leadership qualities. And there's a whole important area to the leadership you provide to the people closest to you that you work with day in, day out.
Yeah.
And I think talking about local versus global impact is something that's worth considering, because the ways you try to have impact and the ways you do are not very deterministic. Yeah. So
you can also put impact on a number of different axes, right?
Yeah,
you can talk about environmental or social or emotional or, you know, advancing your field or
it's complicated.
Yeah. We're not gonna put it on an XY axis, I don't think.
Yeah. So I think thinking about all those different dimensions and where you want to fall in that vector space, if you want, where you want to fall in that space is something that's very personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess a room full of physicists, I can say this metaphor, turn up the temperature on your search. You know, when you're thinking about what you want to do, everything I've gotten into that's been really interesting, I've almost kind of stumbled into, but I stumble on purpose because I have a very high temperature search. I just, you know, I look at things that are kind of outside of what I'm qualified to do and what I thought I might be interested in, and I have a big network that involves people in lots of crazy different fields, just kind of because. Like, you know, it helps to be related to every Democrat in South Dakota. There's like 60, and most of them are first cousins, and for a while, one of them was the leader of the Senate. So, you know, these things happen. But if you turn up the temperature and are willing to like fall into different pockets further out, it's not a terrible strategy for me. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it work for other people. I have seen it crash and fail too, because that's what high temperature searches do. But
great, thank you. Well, maybe we're kind of getting close towards the end of our session, but if there's a burning question, you can come down. But I wanted to ask you guys sort of in closing, you know, if you could take a time machine to go back to a point in your youth and give some advice to a younger self, is there any words of wisdom that you would have wanted to hear maybe in those transition times or inflection points? Or maybe we'll start on this side this time.
Maybe this isn't what I wanted to hear back then, but it's probably what I needed to hear, which I would just say that being smart's not that important. And it's not that well defined. There's so many other different types of skills and talents and things to explore out there. And I think for me, feeling like leaving was hard because on the one hand, I trusted being smart, but on the other hand, I also felt like I was letting down my intelligence by not pursuing an academic path. And I've just found that my mind has expanded by not pursuing such a narrow path. And not letting my ego get so wrapped up in being smart is probably one of the best things I could have done back then, and I wish I'd done it faster. Because being smart just doesn't matter. It just doesn't.
I don't know. Personally, if I could go back to any point in time in my life, I would always tell myself not to worry so much. That's just a personal thing. Something that was kind of done for me, so I guess I didn't need to be told, was just like throughout my projects, professors forced me to learn applicable skills like programming and like machine learning and stuff worked its way in there. So sort of try to two birds with one stone, like learn as many skills as you can and work it into something that you're already doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, I always have trouble with this question because the only things I can think about were the things that people actually did tell me and which, well, some of them I ignored, but mostly the things that I've struggled to follow really ever since and still do. I guess the big one for me is probably, you know, respecting the fact that I could learn a lot from other people. And, you know, I had a grade 11 teacher who I loved dearly and who I think, you know, also liked me. But, you know, he told me, like, you know, you don't respect other people enough and what you can learn from them. And he was right. He was very right then, and he's still right now, actually, you know. And I really still struggle with that, you know. I always sort of thought, well, there was, you know, there was me and there were people who were smarter than me and maybe I could learn from them. You know, and it's awful to say that, right? I mean, I'm basically making myself sound really awful by saying that, but it's true, you know?
It's a safe
feel
room.
That. Well, maybe it's a safe room to say it, but I would say it anyways because it's one of the things I've worked hardest on. And occasionally, you know, I said I suck people dry, right? Occasionally I've like managed to find the person and I'm like, okay, that person I can do this with. But I still like kind of look around at people very carefully, like, can I get that person, you know? Like, can I overcome my emotional issues to, you know, learn from that person? And sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes it's no. But I do feel like that, you know, learning from other people thing is the thing that I wish I'd gotten earlier, I guess. Yeah, maybe I could have taken it more seriously more earlier. Yeah.
I guess I would like to tell my younger self not to pick a path and set out so firmly on it so early. And also a little bit later, tell my slightly older self that leaving that path is not necessarily a failure. That you can take a right turn or a left turn or just change your direction entirely. And it's, you know, it doesn't have to be failure. So I wish I had known that as a graduate student. And as an undergraduate, I wish I had understood that pursuing your other passions is, you know, not just something that you do because it's fun and it's college or university and you know, indulge yourself. It's something that's actually valuable.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like you do have a question.
So earlier you mentioned you had this, or you all had kind of like X factors, so-called X factors outside mm-hmm. of physics. What would you say are your X factors, and how did you find them, and how did you kind of use them to get into what you're into now?
Mm-hmm. Who's got an X factor?
So my mom, oh, this is really bad to use what my mom says, but my mommy always told me, my mom used to always like to say that I was a nerd who spoke human. And that translator skill is really, really valuable in the rest of the world because people are so intrigued by technical things. I think I figured this skill out while I was still in school because I think I did a little bit of work with outreach as well. And it was something that was always important to me to make sure that the communication lines were open. So I figured that X factor out while I was still in school. It was just a matter of translating it to the rest of the world took a little bit of time.
I don't really know what I'd say for mine. maybe hockey. Hear me out. Like when I moved to Portland, it was a really great way to meet people and that you wouldn't normally meet. So I interact with a lot of people who don't work at Intel, whereas a lot of people who started at the same time with me, as me are like, how do you make friends? And it's people from different walks of life, you know?
That's cool. That's a great example.
Yeah, all the things that I can think of are really just about being a physicist.
but once you leave physics is your X factor.
I think though, you know, the thing I might say is that I feel like those of us who are here are probably, we would probably all describe ourselves as probably fairly analytical, I'm guessing. Most people here would say that. But I do think there's something that can either happen or not happen, which is applying those analysis skills to sort of soft problems, essentially. And I think I do that fairly well, I guess, and that's something I would say I've used a lot. Other than physics, outside of physics, I use this sort of, you know, physics-ish skill, but, you know, applying it to the sort of soft problem of, you know, managing people or figuring out, you know, why is this event, you know, not, you know, successful or, you know, whatever, so.
If I can just jump in to offer a term, the way I like to describe that is taking an analytical skill and drawing insight. And I think oftentimes it
drawing insight, did you say?
Yeah, drawing insight. And I think if you stick with just the analytical, that's where you don't make that branch. But I think what you're talking about there, to me, is drawing out insight. Mm. And then it can be translated across your problems.
Well, that was helpful. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. I like that term.
You're speaking human. Thank you.
I guess my X factor is fairly obvious. I can communicate. But actually, once you leave physics becomes your X factor. I mean, in this room, everybody is the physicist. Outside in the world, I don't know if you've noticed this, but they're fairly rare, particularly if you go like more than a 2 or 3 block radius away from this place.
Not here,
but this is a local anomaly. And it's easy to lose sight of that. And what you said earlier is you kind of have to spell it out for people. It's like, what is being a physicist good for? Good for being in over your head. It's good for tackling hard problems, like impossibly hard problems that the brightest minds in the world have been working on for the last 80 years, and I thought I'd take a crack at it. You know, it's good for being a self-starter, finding your own research direction. It's good for following through. It's good for network, you know, because you never know everything you need to know, and you've always got to grab the person who can debug your code, or, you know, I was an experimental physicist, so you always have to make friends with the people in the gas lab who can hook up your hydrogen for you. you know, he's a French guy and he chain smoked all the time. Terrifying. Once you leave physics, that becomes your X factor. And if you can combine that with your other passions, it can be an interesting path.
That's a fantastic summary. Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually a nice way, I think, that we'll close our session. I think one of the things that we've tried to build into the day is lots of longer breaks and longer lunches, so you can get a chance to chat one-on-one with everyone. And I believe all of you are at least going to be here during lunch. So. And are keen, if you were too shy or had a question that was more specific, I think you can find one of these lovely ladies during the lunch session. So please, let's thank everyone, our panelists, for joining us today.